Hello and welcome to Religion in the News. I'm Brian LeBlanc, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and today we'll be featuring articles from Christianity Today, from the Associated Press, from the Washington Post, and more. Today's broadcast is generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424, and we thank them for their contribution. The contents of this program are intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Let's get started this week on Religion in the News with an article from Christianity Today, dated May 28th. And the title of this article, George Floyd Left a Gospel Legacy in Houston. The subheadline, As a Person of Peace, Big Floyd Opened Up Ministry Opportunities in the Third Ward Housing Projects. And this is by Kate Shelnut of Christianity Today. The rest of the country knows George Floyd from several minutes of cell phone footage captured during his final hours. But in Houston's Third Ward, they know Floyd for how he lived for decades, a mentor to a generation of young men and a person of peace, ushering ministries into the area. Before moving to Minneapolis for a job opportunity through a Christian work program, the 46-year-old spent almost his entire life in the historically black Third Ward, where he was called Big Floyd and regarded as an OG, a de facto community leader and elder statesman, his ministry partners say. Floyd spoke of breaking the cycle of violence he saw among young people and used his influence to bring outside ministries to the area to do discipleship and outreach, particularly in the CUNY Homes housing project, locally known as the Bricks. George Floyd was a person of peace sent from the Lord that helped the gospel go forward in a place that I never lived in, said Patrick P.T. Ngwolo, pastor of Resurrection Houston, which held services at CUNY. The platform for us to reach that neighborhood and the hundreds of people we reached through that time and up to now was built on the backs of people like Floyd, he told Christianity Today. Ngwolo and fellow leaders met Floyd in 2010. He was a towering 6'6" guest who showed up at a benefit concert they put on for the Third Ward. From the start, Big Floyd made his priorities clear. He said, I love what you're doing. The neighborhood needs it. The community needs it. And if you're all about God's business, then that's my business, said Corey Paul Davis, a Christian hip-hop artist who attended Resurrection Houston. He said, whatever y'all need, wherever y'all need to go, tell them Floyd said y'all good. I got y'all. The church expanded its involvement in the area, holding Bible studies and helping out with groceries and rides to doctor's appointments. Floyd didn't just provide access and protection. He lent a helping hand as the church put on services, three-on-three basketball tournaments, barbecues, and community baptisms. He helped push the baptism tub over, understanding that people were going to make a decision of faith and get baptized right there in the middle of the projects. He thought that was amazing, said Ronnie Lillard, who performs under the name Reconcile. The things that he would say to young men always referenced that God trumps street culture. I think he wanted to see young men put guns down and have Jesus instead of the streets. More than 50 people have been killed over the past several years in what authorities describe as a gang war spreading from the Third Ward in southeast Houston. It can be hard for outsiders to gain trust or even ensure safety coming in on their own. The stamp of approval granted from a figure like Floyd is crucial for urban discipleship, which requires access, direction, and context to be effective. His faith was a heart for the Third Ward that was radically changed by the gospel, and his mission was empowering other believers to be able to come in and push that gospel forth, said Nijalon Dunn, who was baptized at CUNY. There were things that Floyd did for us that we'll never know until the other side of eternity. There were times where we'd have church at the Bricks until 3 p.m., and by 4:30 they're firing shots right at the basketball courts. Dunn shared pictures of Floyd at his baptism and basketball games. Floyd's handle included the name Big Floyd for God. Tributes and prayers of lament from fellow Christians rolled in over social media as the news of Floyd's death spread this week. On Twitter, Davis described Floyd as the definition of be the change you want to see, and shared a video tribute that has been viewed 1.1 million times. Popular Christian hip-hop artist Propaganda reposted the reflections from fellow artists who knew Floyd, saying, he was a friend of my friends. Floyd moved to Minneapolis around 2018, his family told the Houston Chronicle. He was there for a discipleship program, including a job placement, according to Pastor Nwolo. A BRICS boy doesn't just leave the Third Ward and go to Minnesota, he said. Floyd told Dunn he had plans to return this summer. Though he never made it home, he'll be immortalized in the Third Ward community forever, Lillard said. His mural will be on the walls. Every youth and young man growing up will know George Floyd. The people who knew him personally will remember him as a positive light. Guys from the streets looked to him like, man, if he can change his life, I can change mine. Ministry leaders have heard from community members in the Third Ward who called Floyd their brother, uncle, or even their dad because they lacked older male figures to serve as a positive influence. Mourners gathered Tuesday night for a prayer vigil in Emancipation Park, a historic Third Ward site that was once the only park open to African Americans in Houston during Jim Crow segregation. Nwolo is meeting this week with area pastors to lament together. The viral video of Floyd being pinned to the pavement by a Minneapolis police officer joins a devastated canon of cell phone footage depicting police using force against black men. His friends in ministry said that when it turned up on the news, they weren't ready to watch another clip so soon after the recording of Ahmaud Arbery being shot while jogging in Georgia, and the video of a woman calling 911 on a black man watching birds in New York Central Park. But then Lillard texted, "It was Big Floyd." There's only so much disbelief they can muster from this kind of killing. They're black men, too. Despite their innocence, their faith, their good deeds, they have their own stories of being suspected, humiliated, and threatened by authorities, Lillard told CT. And now they're put in the position of rightly remembering a man they knew as a gentle giant, an inspiration to his neighborhood, and a positive force for change. But they also say that shouldn't matter. He was a fellow image bearer, and that should have been enough to keep him from the aggressive treatment they saw in the viral clip. Floyd's family and supporters say the officers involved, who were fired from the department, should face murder charges. Pastor Nwolo is still trying to process the news, but one theme he keeps coming back to is the shedding of innocent blood. After Cain's superiority and animosity drove him to kill Abel, Scripture tells us, the Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground." If you fast forward 2,000 years, there's another innocent sufferer whose blood spoke of better things than Abel's. Jesus' blood says he can redeem us through these dark and perilous times, Nwolo said. I have hope, because just like Abel is a Christ figure, I see my brother Floyd as a Christ figure as well, pointing us to a greater reality. God does hear us. He hears his cry even from the ground now. Vengeance will either happen on the cross or will happen on Judgment Day. Our next article this week comes from the Associated Press, dated June 3rd. The headline, "Amid Protests, U.S. Faith Leaders Engage Racism and Politics." This is by Elena Shore of the Associated Press, Dateline New York. As days of anti-racism protests sparked by police killings push Americans toward a national reckoning, religious leaders are stepping more directly into the politics surrounding discrimination, entering into a dialogue that cuts across lines of faith and color. Groups from multiple denominations across Christian, Jewish, and Muslim faiths have publicly called for action against racism, aligning with peaceful demonstrators' goals following the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Even beyond those statements, the amount and diversity of religious involvement in the ongoing protests suggests a possible sea change for faith-driven engagement in racial justice issues. "I've seen people of different faiths coming out and saying this was wrong in ways I didn't see before," said Reverend Tracy Blackman, Associate General Minister of Justice at the United Church of Christ and an early spiritual leader in the Black Lives Matter movement. Religion's role in struggles against racial bias long predates Floyd's killing, which sparked mass demonstrations across the United States and even in other countries. But a notable shift has taken place. Among those who've publicly backed protesters are clergy from the Southern Baptist Convention, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and Orthodox and Reform Judaism. Meanwhile, Catholic and Episcopal leaders openly criticized President Donald Trump after peaceful demonstrators were forcefully cleared to make way for his brief visit and photo op outside the historic St. John's Church near the White House. On Wednesday, Bishop Latrell Easterling, leader of the United Methodist Church's Washington Area Conference, joined Reverend Marianne Buddy, the bishop of Washington's Episcopal Diocese, which includes St. John's, and other faith leaders for a prayer vigil that aimed to orient the religious conversation around fighting racism. I think that all leaders that consider themselves to be religious or moral leaders have an obligation to rise and to speak to this moment, because institutional racism and supremacy cannot be dismantled by African American leaders alone, said Easterling, who is African American. Those who enjoy the privilege of those systems must rise. The vigil was initially set to take place at St. John's, but had to move to a nearby block after local law enforcement extended the security perimeter around the White House. Buddy, who expressed outrage Monday over Trump's use of St. John's as a backdrop, said white Americans need to engage more in the realities of this country that we are allowed to be blind in ways that cost people of color. Trump's visit, in which he held up a Bible and said, "We have a great country," was at least in part intended as a show of solidarity with faith, according to the White House. But the maneuver nudged Buddy and other religious leaders to wade further into the political realm, airing their disagreement. Reverend Russell Moore, leader of the Southern Baptist's public policy arm, issued a statement in response to the visit, calling the killing of African Americans, the use of force against peaceful protesters, and the destruction of property morally wrong. "I am brokenhearted and alarmed by all of this," said Moore, whose criticism of Trump during the 2016 campaign prompted the then candidate to blast him as a terrible representative of evangelicals. Many black religious leaders are welcoming the new allies, while lamenting that it took Floyd's death to jar white congregations into paying attention. Twin Cities-based minister Janae Bates, who works with progressive faith groups, said she's glad to see diverse conversations about racism, but it's really harmful and hurtful that it takes yet another body for us to get there. "We've had many faith leaders who are awakening to the hypocrisy of a freedom-for-all America," Bates added, saying such clergy are experiencing a lot of cognitive dissonance as their visions of an equitable society crumble. Imam Makram El-Amin of Minneapolis' Masjid An-Nur Mosque, which has been supporting neighbors amid the protests in that city, said people of faith should be part of a diverse front against racism. But, he said, voices of those who have been subject to this oppression, in this case African Americans, should be the leading voices. One of Trump's staunchest evangelical backers, Reverend Franklin Graham, decried the violence that has broken out at a number of protests and lauded Trump's visit to the church. But even he allowed that clergy have more work to do in talking to minority communities, saying in an interview that "we certainly do that in his ministries, but that doesn't mean we can't do it better." Other white faith leaders are focusing on helping their flock wrestle with tense and sometimes uncomfortable questions about race, bias, and privilege. An honest dialogue in white congregations requires both brave clergy and willing people in the pews, said Reverend Joshua Whitfield, a priest at the St. Rita Catholic Community in Dallas. "I think the moment is ripe for people to let go and say, I do need to look at this more deeply. I do need to explore the original sin," Whitfield said. Blackman, who pastors in Missouri, urged her white counterparts to take their words as of support for healing racial injustice a step further and treat deep-rooted bias as a universal problem requiring more action. "I'm grateful they're saying these things, but what I want from you is what costs you. Will you be there when it costs you?" Blackman said. "And for me, that's in the Capitol, in the State House, in the courthouse, in places where systemic racism rages." Our next article this week on religion in the news comes from the Washington Post, dated June 4th. And the headline on this article, "Southern Baptists See Historic Drop in Membership." And this is by Sarah Pulliam Bailey of the Washington Post. Total membership in the nation's largest Protestant denomination fell at a historic rate between 2018 and 2019, according to an annual report released Thursday. The Southern Baptist Convention said it had 14.5 million members in 2019, down about 287,655 from the previous year. Membership dropped 2%, the largest single-year drop in more than 100 years, according to a survey from Lifeway Christian Resources, the denomination's publishing and research arm. The decline reflects a larger trend of Americans leaving Christianity at a rapid pace. According to the Pew Research Center, 65% of Americans describe themselves as Christians, down 12 percentage points during the past decade. Southern Baptist baptisms fell by more than 4%, a key metric in measuring new members of the faith. Average weekly worship service and Sunday school or small group attendance each dropped by less than 1%. Giving was down, and total church receipts fell 1.44% to $11.6 billion. The Southern Baptist Convention is not immune to the increasing secularization among Americans that is seen in more of our children and our neighbors not having interest in coming to Jesus, Scott McConnell, executive director of Lifeway Research, said in a statement. The Southern Baptist Convention, or SBC, has been in steady decline for nearly 15 years, hitting its peak in 2006 at 16.3 million. The convention has been in turmoil in recent years, spending the bulk of its annual meeting in 2019 on the issue of sex abuse after the Houston Chronicle published reports on the issue in Southern Baptist churches. The convention has also hosted controversies over an invitation for Vice President Pence to speak at its meeting, faced difficulty in passing a resolution to decry the alt-right, and held theological debates over the role of God's sovereignty. The denomination's current president, J.D. Greer, a 47-year-old megachurch pastor from North Carolina, has brought a younger face to the convention, adding more people of color to committees that had been more predominantly white. In a forthcoming piece for the Baptist Press, shared with the Washington Post, Greer wrote that he was grieved by the news that the denomination was on the decline. "Too many of us care more about whether our side is winning in the news cycle than we do the souls of our neighbors. So division on secondary issues more than we point people to Jesus, and focus more on preserving our traditions than reaching our grandchildren," he wrote. Southern Baptists place a heavy emphasis on church planting, and the number of churches grew slightly during the same period. The SBC has 47,530 churches in total, and 74 were added between 2018 and 2019. The survey released Thursday was compiled by Lifeway Christian Resources based on self-reported data from SBC churches. Ronnie Floyd, who leads the SBC's executive committee, said in a statement that 75% of churches participate in the survey, and that clearly it is imperative for our future that evangelism remains the priority of our churches and convention. The convention was supposed to hold its annual meeting next week in Orlando, but canceled due to the novel coronavirus. As fewer Americans identify as Christian, researchers see a growing number of people identifying as non-religious. 17% of Americans now describe their religion as nothing in particular, up from 12% in 2009, according to Pew. Our next article this week comes from Religion News Service, dated, this is actually an older article, dated May 5th. The headline, "An Old World Torah Scroll in North Carolina, Unites a North Carolina Synagogue in a Time of Pandemic." And this is by Yonat Shimron of Religion News Service. When Henry Fuchs acquired a Torah scroll from the Hungarian synagogue he belonged to as a child, it came with two conditions. First, that the scroll, painstakingly written in ink on parchment, be used regularly in services at Fuchs Synagogue in North Carolina, where he now lives. And second, that his congregation recite the Mourner's Kaddish, or Prayer for the Dead, once a year in memory of the 1,000 Hungarian Jews of Tokaj. In May 1944, the town's Jews were marched into cattle cars and sent to Auschwitz. Fewer than 100 survived. Fuchs, a professor of computer science at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, has honored these two conditions. Since the scroll came into his possession 18 years ago, it has been housed inside the Ark at his place of worship, the Kahilla Synagogue in Chapel Hill, where it is part of a rotation of the congregation's four Torah scrolls. But since the coronavirus pandemic began, the scroll has taken on a starring role on Zoom. Every Saturday, when Kahilla members gather online for services, one of the Zoom video screens shows the Tokaj Torah scroll, which resides for the duration of the lockdown in Fuchs' home office. When it comes time to read the weekly Torah portion, Fuchs lays it out on a table and unfurls it to the allotted chapter and verse, as the rabbi or one of the congregants reads from it and everyone else watches online. After all these years of gathering dust in this little chapel in Tokaj, it's now being used and appreciated, said Fuchs, age 72. The Torah, Judaism's central religious text and the backbone for all later Jewish law and commentary, is the faith's holiest religious object. The scroll must be written by hand with a quill, a process that takes at least a year. It often weighs more than 20 pounds. Jews rise to honor it whenever it is opened. At a time when people across the world are dying to a virulent virus, the Hungarian scroll, a testament to the human toll of the Holocaust, reminds us of our own resilience and all the situations Jews have been through the ages, said Rabbi Jen Feldman, the congregation's leader. It gives us strength right now. That perhaps was the intention behind the two conditions given by the Jews of Tokai. For years, the scroll, which was completed in the 1890s, lay dormant. Fuchs thinks it may have been commissioned for the opening of the synagogue in 1895. The grand three-story building with arched windows crowned with a Star of David was the largest in town. Jews were drawn to Tokai for its winemaking. The town's syrupy, amber-tinted wine was beloved in the courts of European royalty. But after two centuries of prosperity, the fate of its Jewish population collapsed with the rise of Nazism. By 1944, the town's Jews were deported to a ghetto, and from there to Auschwitz. About 800, including Fuchs's maternal grandparents, were gassed almost as soon as they arrived. Those who returned to Tokai after the war, including Fuchs's parents, found the town's synagogue in shambles. The Torahs, stowed for safekeeping in the basement of the town's Orthodox Christian priest, survived, but little else did. The decimated ranks of Tokai's Jews held services in a small chapel, while the main building was chopped into apartments. During the Hungarian Revolution of 1956, the Fuchses, then a family of four, fled for the United States. On a return visit to Tokai in 1989, the family found the synagogue's ark empty. 2 years ago, someone had tried to break into the chapel, and the handful of remaining Jews decided the building was no longer safe. They weren't meeting anyway. There were not enough Jews to form a minyan, or quorum of 10 required for public worship. There was such a sad feeling that this was the end of the line for the Jews of Tokai, Fuchs said. Several of the scrolls eventually made their way to an Orthodox Jewish synagogue in the southern Israeli town of Beersheba, where they were repaired and refurbished. Fuchs, who had followed their migration, eventually convinced the Israeli synagogue that as one of the few remaining Jews of Tokai, he should have one. It arrived in North Carolina in 2002, just in time for Fuchs's son's bar mitzvah. In the years that followed, the Kehilla Synagogue honored the Tokai Torah, especially on the Jewish holiday of Shavuot, also known as the Festival of Weeks. In keeping with Hungarian tradition, congregants wore flower garlands and crowned the two posts of the Torah. They then recited the mourner's prayer for the Jews of Tokai who were killed on the second day of the holiday. In March, when the coronavirus began to spread and houses of worship canceled in-person services, Fuchs's congregation considered how to move to virtual services. Feldman suggested she drive to the synagogue each Shabbat and read from one of the congregation's four Torah scrolls while members follow along on their computers from home. Fuchs had another idea. He could take the Tokai Torah scroll to his house and open it to that week's Torah portion for all to see on Zoom. In the weeks that followed, he did just that, linking his American congregation even more closely to the Hungarian one that no longer existed. At a time when Jews can no longer gather in person for services, this artifact of another time is uniting them. On a recent Saturday, two boys marking their bar mitzvah read from the scroll as it appeared in the Zoom window online. Fuchs, using a yad, or silver Torah pointer, led the way. 75 Zoom screens followed along. Feldman, the rabbi, orchestrated the service from her office. "It's palpable to me how we were all held together by Torah," she said. "We're being brought together through Torah." For our last article this week on religion in the news, we'll jump back to the Associated Press and an article dated June 4th. In the headline, "Eyebrows Raised as Swiss Bishop Taps Woman for Senior Job." This is by Nadine Ashwai-Lesage and Jamie Keaton of the AP, dateline Freiburg, Switzerland. A Swiss bishop's appointment of a lay mother of three to a senior administrative post previously held by a priest has raised eyebrows in conservative Catholic circles at a time when a strengthened role for women in the church is under debate in other European countries. Marianne Paul Hensen will serve as an episcopal delegate in the Diocese of Lausanne, Geneva, and Freiburg,
and will also be joining Bishop Charles Morrod's Episcopal Council, the main governance advisory body, which is traditionally made up of priests and bishops. Pope Francis has insisted women should be given greater decision-making roles in church governance. He has recently reconstituted a study commission on whether women can be ordained deacons, but has upheld a ban on women priests and counts no women among his top advisors. Church conservatives are particularly sensitive to any moves involving women in decision-making roles usually reserved for men, fearing they could set in motion changes that could eventually lead to women being ordained priests. Swiss church leaders insist Paul Hensen's role as Episcopal delegate for the German-speaking part of the Freiburg Canton, or region, will be different from that of her predecessor. He had been an Episcopal vicar, which under church law is an ordained priest whose main task is to help the bishop govern a part of his diocese, including with authority over priests. Paul Hensen, who had been the vicar's number two for years, is simply rising to the top job on August 1st. She says she obviously wouldn't carry out key religious duties that only a priest could. "It's a small step," she said in an interview. "If other steps happen when it comes to women in the church, it will be through men first. For example, perhaps the requirement of the celibacy of priests will fall. The next step could be women as deacons, and maybe far, far later, women as priests. But we know many people don't want that to happen, so we cannot push much," she added. "We need to take it step by step." Catholic doctrine reserves the priesthood for men, and church tradition requires Latin Rite priests to be celibate. Like many countries in Western Europe, Switzerland has seen a steady collapse in the number of Catholic priestly vocations, with fewer than a dozen new diocesan priests ordained each year for the past several years, according to Vatican statistics. Morrod said his move was about letting priests do the job of priests and outsourcing administrative matters to a layperson, irrespective of gender. In a phone interview, Morrod said he hadn't received any reproach from the Vatican over Paul Hensen's appointment. Paul Hensen said some not very flattering comments were made about Morrod after her appointment was announced last month, but added that many in her community have congratulated her over it. Some conservative and traditionalist Catholic commentators in Italy and the United States have claimed that the appointment is ambiguous, since she apparently will be doing the work of a vicar, but with a different title. But the Reverend Robert Gall, a moral theologian at the Opus Dei-run Pontifical Holy Cross University in Rome, said the title change is crucial, and Morrod clearly is not making her a vicar. Marianne Paul Hensen seems to have proved her capabilities in bringing diverse language groups that sometimes have conflicts, he said by email, adding, "It's wonderful that she has the confidence of the bishop." Gall said her appointment to the Episcopal Council was also to be welcomed, saying it brings the possibility to offer a new perspective. Conservatives' fear has been heightened because of a push in neighboring Germany to open up even more leadership roles to women and an official dialogue process launched earlier this year between Germany's bishops and a powerful lay group that is demanding change. Even traditionally Catholic France is seeing women increasingly protest their second-class status in the church, fueled in part by clergy sex abuse and cover-up scandals. In Lyon, Anne Supa has made a splash with her unprecedented, symbolic, and self-admittedly impossible bid to take up the post of archbishop, left vacant after the resignation of former Cardinal Philippe Arabin. He was convicted, then acquitted, of covering up for a pedophile priest. We've reached the end of our time for this week on Religion in the News. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Brian LeBlanc, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Don't forget that this episode is available as a podcast on our website by visiting ncreadingservice.org. We'll talk to you next time on Religion in the News.